The Democrats don't like being called an angry mob, but really, that's what they've become. They've gone so far left, they can't even believe that they're over there. They don't know what's going on. When you listen to Eric Holder talking about kicking,
when they go low, we kick.
Or Hillary Clinton saying what she said, which was so horrible.
You cannot be civil.
They just don't see it. Maxine Waters constantly, day in and day out, ranting and raving. They're losing it, and they shouldn't be. We should be a unified country. It'll happen someday.
Let's get ready to midterm. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch, and that was, of course, your president making what is clearly his new favorite pitch here. Jobs, not mobs. 2 weeks before the most important midterm elections in the history of voting. As ever on this podcast, which you should immediately subscribe to on iTunes if you don't already, I am joined in our political vivisections by my cantankerous colleagues, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu. It's hard to pronounce. Ward, hi.
Hi. Mangu.
Hey, Matt.
Mangu.
Sometimes, yeah,
it's the same
hard.
Every week.
You'd think Mondays are rough. Listen, so we got 14 days or so before midterm. So we're going to set the stage here and maybe approach things a little bit differently. As of this morning, I believe the 538 prediction, which has the best graphical representation, so that's the one I'll go with, says there's a 6-7 chance that the House will flip to the Democratic Party control. I think their highest recommendation or prediction is that there'll be a net plus 40 of Democratic seats. 538 also says there's a 7-9 chance that Republicans keep the Senate, pretty much the most likely scenario being at the same ratio now, which is 51-49. There's other interesting ephemera, such as that Scott Walker might lose the governorship of Wisconsin, which would be pretty interesting. Gary Johnson is in the mix in New Mexico, although polling is obscure. It's unclear what's going on there. There's a bunch of ballot initiatives. But to kick off our conversation here, because, you know, hashtag libertarian and whatnot, at a moment in which it seems so much of politics is motivated by a significant disdain for the capital O other, let's start our conversation by talking about who we each individually want to see lose the most here in November. And Nick, since your heart is filled with the most hate, at least on Mondays, who do you want to see precisely lose the most 2 weeks from now?
I could have answered that question easily even a couple days ago, and at this point I just don't care. I would like to see Scott Walker lose because of the Foxconn deal and the whole I'm sick of small government Republicans who are actually big government Republicans, and I would like to see Ted Cruz lose just because he's a kind of douche. But, the fact of the matter is Beto O'Rourke is so terrible and the media is in love with him. You know, I mean, I don't want anyone to lose, Matt. I just want libertarians to win all over the place. And I would love to see Gary Johnson actually do really like off the charts well in New Mexico, whether if that means he wins or not is less important to me than to see a serious challenge to the two-party duopoly, because I mean they are fielding just across the country they're fielding candidates that nobody wants, and O'Rourke in a lot of ways is the worst example of that, because he's getting this, fanboy, mother cat tongue licking bath of warmth from the media when the numbers aren't there, except in fundraising. And that's because I guess people don't want to spend money on poor people. So they're going to spend it on Beto O'Rourke. But so I don't want anyone to lose. I just want I want the two-party system to lose. Let me put it that way.
The media mother cat tongue bath, that's what you had there, is managing to derail my early enthusiasm for Beto O'Rourke. I've interviewed him a few times for recent because he came out early against the drug war in 2009 and primaried.
And he's pretty good on immigration as well, was anyway.
And also caucus with Blue Dog Democrats, so it isn't totally psycho on economics, or wasn't. But it's hard not to to react to the skateboarding love with a certain type of revulsion over there. Suderman, who do you want to see lose?
Oh, that's easy. Steve King from Ohio. Excuse me. Let's start that again. It's not so easy, apparently, because Mondays are terrible.
You can do it.
Everybody named King. Everybody named King.
Let's go with Representative Steve King from Iowa, 4th District, who has just been ramping up the kind of white nationalist, race-baiting, anti-immigrant rhetoric that has always been a significant part of his identity as a politician, and now has basically overtaken it. He's just terrified of, of the replacement of whites, and has basically made his entire political agenda about fear of racial and demographic change in the country. And it is, if it's not white nationalism, it's certainly flirting with it. It's very close to it. He has given interviews with publications that are associated with white nationalism, endorsed a Canadian political candidate who got fired after doing an interview, I believe, with the Daily Stormer. And it's sort of gross. I mean, this is a guy who's also, he's like put this stuff in legislative form. It's not just that he sort of says crazy things on obscure radio programs. He has proposed ending birthright citizenship here in the United States. He is really an exemplar of the Republican Party's absolute worst tendencies when it comes to immigration and when it comes to race. And he shouldn't be part of the national political discussion. I very much hope that he loses somehow, if not this November, then November 2 years from now, or November 2 years after that.
Does he have any chance of losing, though, Peter?
I doubt it. That's sort of how Iowa rolls. I mean, it's crazy. You know, Iowa controls a huge amount of national politics because they're placed in the primary system. Yeah. And as a result, I think and Iowa keeps reelecting him, either despite or more likely because of this rhetoric. And Iowa is extremely parts of Iowa, Republican Iowa, is very anti-immigrant, despite the fact that they don't. It's not like an immigrant rich population. It is already relatively insulated from immigrants. And it's really very strange and I think very destructive for the national politics, the way that Iowa's anti-immigrant opposition to any kind of immigration ever has taken hold of certainly of the Republican Party and pulled it to the right in ways.
Yeah, he's also, just to kind of underscore what you're talking about, Peter, years ago he talked about electrifying the border fence, such as it was between the U.S. and Mexico, and he said we do it with livestock all the time. That was one of his early kind of forays into things, and then more recently, he talked about how you can't restore your civilization with other people's babies, I mean, there's a circle of hell for Steve King, but right now we're the ones living in Steve King's hell. But
the an important thing to point out for people who believe that history. That the bad history only began on January 20th, 2017, is that King's been around for a long time. People have been kissing his ring precisely because of his kingmaker status in the Iowa primaries for a long time. Like Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who's been a popular Republican figure. It's long since before Donald Trump was, super Mr. Anti-immigration. So this is a pathology that has existed in the Republican Party for a long time.
But the party, I think, has become more, if not actually more king-like, it has become more open about its about being king-like. Under Trump, and you know, he has said, King has said, he feels like his job today is to pull Trump to the right, and to, and in particular on immigration issues, which is crazy. Like, how do you get more restrictionist than Trump on immigration issues? Well, actually, you can. It's looks like Steve King.
I will go next, since I have a suspicion who Catherine's going to say, and say that kind of piggybacking on Nick's name check of Ted Cruz, I want to take out another Cuban American, Bobby Menendez from the Senate in New Jersey. There is something to be said about not wanting your politics to be, you know, your source of moralization and moral centeredness and all that kind of stuff. I get that. We don't look to politics to inspire you and all this kind of stuff. It's a kind of a zero sum. What are they going to do with your money type of thing? That said, it is also, I think, important, particularly at this time, particularly with this president, but also other people like Steve King. And again, everyone named King, including Larry King. Enough, Larry King.
he had his time.
What about punish? What about John King from CNN?
How about Martin Luther King?
Yeah,
we're gonna not give
Martin
that guy
Luther
a,
King.
You know,
okay.
Kings who are alive. Okay,
wow.
Kings who are dead are better. John King, though, is a hero for his Osama. For his Osama bin Laden announcement. Remember the White House Correspondents' Dinner? He comes on just stone cold wasted and tries to slur through a very important announcement. That was heroic. He speaks to me forever.
Am I wrong to sometimes confuse John King with Shep Smith?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very wrong.
I think they have like the same kind of visage. You know,
nope.
They could be cousins.
No? You're deeply wrong about that.
I mean, I think here on the Reason podcast, we're against all kinds of kings, right? Not just people named King, but like monarchs.
No, actual kings. Princes, too.
Yeah.
No, princes don't do so well. Princesses, as long as they're Disney princesses, maybe.
I think we're against those now, too.
No.
God damn it.
Never. Bobby Menendez is a corrupt New Jersey politician and redundant, but
nobody calls him Bobby.
I call him Bobby.
Yeah.
Right?
You're trying to other him, Matt. Just call him Robert Menendez.
No. He's
Beto Menendez.
At some point, you should be punished and fired for being an openly amoral, corrupt D-bag. And I think our politics and our governance would be better and healthier if, like Ted Cruz in various formats, the way that he has pivoted on a dime on criminal justice reform, openly and snarkily, you know, shiving Mike Lee in the ribs on the Senate floor and this type of thing. That's not good behavior. We should punish bad behavior, whether it's lying, whether it's being corrupt. When Menendez got his name semi-cleared, or at least his legal trouble sorted out, he gave a great press conference. This is like 6, 7, 8 months ago, something like that, where he just snarled and said, "Every one of you Democrats who turned against me, I know who you are. I will punish you." I mean, he was just incredible, open gratitude. So screw you, Menendez. Catherine, who would you like to see fail?
I would like to see Duncan Hunter fail.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just think he's really gone out of his way to win this title from me and from America. So I want to give it to him. Duncan Hunter is, you know, the writers really overreached when they wrote this character. He is it's hard to even know where to start for, like, why you want him to fail. Let's start with his most recent case for failing, which is the campaign ad that was run. I'm not actually sure whether it was by his campaign or simply on his behalf, in which he accuses his opponent of basically doing the Munich bombings.
I've seen that movie.
Yeah. So his opponent is a half Palestinian, half Mexican American man named Amar Kempa Najjar. His grandfather was indeed involved in the bombing of the 1972 Munich Olympics. That said, it's like it's not clear that, like, you know, the taint goes into the blood unto the generations for that sort of thing.
Language.
And among other things, Kempa Najjar he's Christian. He's not Muslim. He's estranged from his family. There's just no reason to accuse him of, in the words of Duncan Hunter's ads, infiltrating Congress. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And that's just the latest. We also, of course, have his proud campaign finance violations, which include sending a campaign staffer to buy some shorts from a golf pro shop and telling that staffer to attribute the expense to a Wounded Warriors program. They paid $600 to fly their pet rabbit on a trip. He once, his wife bought a bunch of makeup, like $150 worth of makeup, and told the campaign they were gift basket items for charity. Like, every single thing this man touches turns to gross. And it goes all the way back. I actually was searching him in preparation for this podcast and found that he was one of the very few Republicans who also supported the V-chip in the 90s. With the statement, this is a conservative, small government approach to helping parents shield their children from unnecessary sex and violence on TV. So he is bad all the way down. I would be delighted to see California Republican Duncan Hunter defeated.
My favorite part of the Hunter indictment has been looking at all the money he spent at various D.C. bars, including notably at Jack Rose Dining Saloon, which is a great establishment. It has one of, if not the largest collection of whiskey in the United, like of just like different bottles of whiskey in the United States and possibly in this hemisphere, I believe is their
focus, Peter, focus.
In any case, Hunter went there and he spent $462.46 one night in campaign funds. And you know what? He's reported to have bought with that is one steak and 30 shots of tequila.
Every single story about this man.
Can I
so
just
not
push
only
back
which
on
to
the...
be there is a reason that I was explaining what that bar is famous for.
It's not tequila.
Tequila.
Shots.
You go and like if you want to, if you're gonna like
but
campaign
why
fund
do we
grift
care about
to the to that level.
Finance.
Okay, so
abuse.
Then let's
then
all...
buy some good whiskey, man.
Okay, calm your pants. Yeah, like obviously we should to be sure the campaign finance laws are bad, et cetera, et cetera. However, it is also bad to ask for money from people to run your political campaign and then spend it on shorts and makeup. And in fact, it's even worse to ask
and
for money
tequila?
For people.
Tequila is speech.
To ask
just
for
like
money for
money,
people to
just like
help
political ads.
Wounded soldiers and spend it on shorts. Like that, you don't need any laws to tell you that that is amoral. It is immoral. It is wrong. It is bad.
Kind of a dick move.
It's a dick move.
Let's shift to positivity, man. Okay? So, Suderman, who do you want to see win?
I don't know. I'm going to go with Nick's answer. I got nothing. We were reading back issues of like the classified ads in old issues of Reason from the 1970s in the office last week because we're fun people and that's what we do when there's whiskey involved. And I think my favorite little ad that I saw was just a bumper sticker that said, "Don't reelect anyone." And I really think, that for $7.50 plus like $4 shipping, we should resurrect this. And I want to put one on the back of my city bike.
Catherine, what's a positive bumper sticker you're going to put in the back of your stupid scooter?
The whole point of the scooter is it's not my scooter. That's why it's great. It's somebody else's okay. scooter I'm just borrowing. More scooters appeared in D.C. this weekend, by the way. There are now Lyft scooters also. So just want you to stay abreast of these important scooter developments.
Catherine Megan Ward, Reason's scooter correspondent.
I wish that was all of my job.
Scooter editor.
Scooter.
We have actually, I think, a scooter correspondent.
It's not even me. Yeah.
You're like a division.
So, I mean, I would be happy, obviously, to see our usual small cadre of friends reelected. You know, let's send back Justin Amash, et cetera, et cetera. The one thing that I actually noticed when I was like searching through Google News to see if there was anyone I didn't hate running that our listeners might not already know about, which is that no one is using the rhetoric of fiscal conservatism or small government conservatism or republicanism at all. Like I searched those terms in Google News this morning and the hits are from the rinky-dinkiest papers and they are often third-party candidates or candidates that have already washed out. I actually am not sure that I had quite realized how much that language had disappeared from this cycle until I went looking for it. So I do not have any, like, diamond in the rough to share with you, unfortunately. But, you know, Justin Amash forever and ever.
There is one Republican, notably, running on the ye old circa 2013 constitutional conservative line, a guy named Eric Brakey in Maine, who's running against another person named King. I believe it's the Angus version of the King. And he actually has endorsed Gary Johnson, which is an interesting thing that only basically Rand Paul has done in the Republican camp. He's a guy, he's a kid, barely age qualified. He was a Twitter or a YouTube sensation for some unfortunate dancing that he had done there. Don't look it up. And he is going to lose by like 25 percentage points. So that's where running on those messages is being rewarded out there in the universe right now. But nice guy, Eric Brake. Talked to him a few times. Nick, are there any, you already name checked Gary Johnson, and we can tell that you have a certain amount of despair in life. Are there any other like positive things that you're looking at all in this election?
And one is the Libertarian candidate in Indiana who's running for Senate named Lucy Brenton, who is against the incumbent Joe Donnelly and the Republican challenger Mike Braun. And she is more than covering the spread. It's a very tight race. Let me just pull that up. She is Donnelly, again, a kind of centrist Democrat who I guess voted for Kavanaugh.
He voted against
him. He ultimately flopped. Away from that. He was one of the ones who was early on might do it. He's a Notre Dame grad, so he's like a super Catholic and whatnot. But he's at 43.7%. Braun is about 3 points behind that, and then Brenton is at 7%. And this is the most I'm hoping for is that where you have a strong spoiler effect. And of course, I realize none of us thinks, you know, the Libertarian more than covering the spread is spoiling anything for anybody, and it isn't. But to really show, I mean, in a state like Indiana, where either an incumbent or a Republican it's generally a Republican state, although it shifts around a bit. But when an incumbent or a Republican there is really weak, I think it shows, you know, a real appetite for something different. And Brenton is kind of more or less following the Libertarian Catechism, which is, you know, ultimately is less government. And this is one of the things that I think we are losing the thread of in this election more than, you know, any other, as you were talking about, Matt, is the idea of, and I guess Catherine mentioned it as well, that the lack of interest in anything related to the size and scope and spending of government. There's some talk about deregulation. There's some talk about tax cuts. Which is all well and good, but I mean, fundamentally, we are spending more money. We are ultimately regulating more things, and you know, whatever mixed things Scott Gottlieb is doing under his jurisdiction in the government, you have trade tariffs that, you know, Ford and BMW are talking about how many, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars they're costing the economy. So,
I mean, this is
more power to Brenton.
This is a huge failure on the part of the Republican Party. Democrats are currently sort of pushing forward a whole bunch of blue sky, big idea plans, some of which may stick, many of which are sort of likely to either get diminished or just kind of not work out. But what's the Republican agenda? The dynamic that you would expect would be the party that wants to expand government and a party that wants to either reform or limit government somehow or another. And right now we have a party that wants to expand government and then another party that doesn't seem to have a domestic policy agenda.
Can I ask to a certain
extent at all?
It's not a.
And certainly,
an agenda
to the extent
yet,
that agenda
point.
Exists, it's not. It's not limiting government in any way. I mean, Donald Trump is running around defending, saying we have to protect Medicare, we have to protect Medicare, we have to protect Medicare. It's the biggest socialist health care program in the country. I mean, it is
so what
the
did
biggest
you think
driver of the
Mitch
federal
McConnell's,
deficit.
What did you think of Mitch McConnell's, comment recently that, you know, we're going to go after entitlement
spending. He didn't say that. What Mitch McConnell said was, you know, I think it's important. It's a thing we need to think about, but it needs to be a bipartisan thing, basically. What Mitch McConnell was basically saying is, we are not going to take responsibility for this as Republicans, and we're not going to lead on this at all. Instead, every once in a while, we'll sort of reference it, make a little tiny gesture. But because we believe they're not even wrong, it would be political suicide. We're going to make no effort to try and change the politics of this. Instead, we're going to wait and see if Democrats ever want to come along, if they feel nervous about a fiscal crisis, anything like that. And at that point, we'll be happy to work together on this. But what he's saying basically is that Republicans aren't going to make this a priority, even if they might like to do some entitlement reforms because a bunch of them think that it's probably a good idea.
I would just to add some numbers on Nick's point spread coverage thing, and Lucy Brenton is leading the field among all Libertarian Party candidates for U.S. Senate, with the exception of Gary Johnson. She's leading in average polls, which is 7%. There's a new one this morning, right at 7%. And she's also clearly leading the field in point spread coverage. There's three or four Senate candidates from the LP who are beating the point spread, as to the very, you know, meager amount of polls that there are out there. And on the governor's side, there's just about eight gubernatorial candidates who are clearing the point spread, led by Jake Porter in Iowa, who's polling at around 7% and beating a tight race by 5 percentage points. And that was your percentage points moment of the podcast. I am going to throw my... Again.
Can I just, before we leave politics per se, but what did you guys think of that, the TMZ footage of Mitch McConnell in the restaurant in Kentucky? I have to admit, like, I do not like Mitch McConnell, but the way he was just sitting there, kind of like, you know, not even worrying about the customer who was ranting at him, who took Mitch's doggy bag and reportedly threw it out on the street. If you haven't watched the actual footage of the guy like going bananas on McConnell, McConnell comes off extremely well.
He did the same thing during, I forget which heated thing, might have been Kavanaugh and some other moment, but there were people who were heckling.
Yeah, he was at Georgetown.
In Georgetown, and like Elaine Chao, his wife, and he's, yes, he's a very funny, I don't give a AF when it
it's
comes
not
to
how you use what? That.
Yeah, that. What? Never mind.
Right. Look, I'm trying to keep it clean here. So my contribution to the person that I would like to see win is a Nebraska state senator. And you might be asking, why would I care about a Nebraska state senator? Well, in this case, Laura Ebke, who's a very interesting politician and legislator there. A couple of years back, she switched from a Republican to the Libertarian Party. It's not the only reason why she's interesting, but although that is, to me, kind of interesting as someone who's a fan of political competition. But she also passed kind of the earliest and best in show reform, statewide reform of occupational licensing, just to name check Shoshana Weissman there and other people who've been working on this. And the issue has been finally kind of breaking through politically. She spearheaded that. And it was actually her independentness or libertarianness, which she argues is part of the reason why she was able to do it, because she was sort of seen as a honest broker between the two major parties. So she is running right now her first reelection as while wearing the L on her sweater, like Laverne. And in the first round of it, she was the top two finalist and was down by about 10 percentage points. I don't have the numbers in front of me. So it's dicey up in the air. So I am interested in it, not just because she has done good things in office, but also there's a handful of party switchers out there who left the GOP for the LP, and to see whether they can actually win election with in that team membership, I think is a pretty important thing going forward. We already started kind of pivoting to the actual issues undergirding everything here. And Suderman, you were sort of talking about Medicare. Walk us through, Peter, if you will, to what extent healthcare is an issue in this election and what that means going forward. And what's your evidence for that being true anyways?
It's a huge issue, and I think that even though it has gotten a fair amount of coverage, it's still undercovered. It has been lost a little bit in the kind of Trump circus. So if you go back to the beginning of this year, March, April, May, you started to see Democrats looking for a message for the 2018 midterms. And they looked back at 2016 and saw that Hillary Clinton running just as like Donald Trump is bad wasn't doing it, especially in the sort of competitive swing districts. Instead, what they sort of settled on after looking at the polls was Republicans are going to take away the pre-existing conditions protections that are built into Obamacare. And so if you recall last year during the Obamacare repeal push, that was arguably the single most successful message from the Democrats. And so they started running ads about healthcare and about how Democrats will protect your healthcare and in particular pre-existing conditions rules. And it helps, of course, it helps the Democratic case that a group of state attorneys generals from red states have launched a lawsuit trying to take all of Obamacare down and that the Trump administration has made the rather unusual, not totally unprecedented, but somewhat unusual decision not to defend the pre-existing conditions rules that are built into Obamacare. And so part of the argument that Democrats made over the summer was that if Brett Kavanaugh gets put on the Supreme Court, he will be the fifth vote to take down Obamacare's pre-existing conditions rules. Now, that wasn't a very good argument, part because this case is bad, in part because Brett Kavanaugh actually wrote an opinion that provides a legal path to preserving those regulations. And so it's unlikely that he'd be the fifth vote. And even if he did vote against those regulations, there's still probably five votes to keep them in place. So that was a pretty bad argument. But Democrats are doing really well with this argument against Republicans, particularly in House and Senate races. And so what you've seen is that Republicans in response have come around in the past couple of weeks and started to say, oh, actually, we're in favor of pre-existing conditions rules. And in some cases, making explicit that they want to save Obamacare's pre-existing conditions rules. In other cases, pointing to some legislation that they say would protect those rules. And Trump is one of these folks has said, look, I'm in favor of pre-existing conditions protections. Any Republican who isn't, I'm going to have a talk with them. They all need to get on board. Also, Democrats are coming for your Medicare. And so you combine the pre-existing condition stuff with Trump really going hard on Medicare and saying that we have to protect Medicare from the threat of single payer, which is socialism, which is crazy because Medicare is socialism. So we have to protect socialism for seniors from the threat of socialism for everybody is basically the argument here. There's some history. Romney kind of tried to make a similar argument about how he favored keeping pre-existing conditions rules. He pointed to a different provision than what Republicans are saying they favor now. But the thing is that Republicans are as always, basically becoming the party of the healthcare status quo. They support Medicare. They support, if not exactly Obamacare, they are rhetorically moving in the direction of supporting Obamacare, even though they don't quite seem to support the pre-existing conditions rules as they are written now, while Democrats are becoming the party of more government involvement in healthcare. And so that's the healthcare debate we have right now is let's protect Medicare for seniors. And Obamacare's pre-existing conditions rules are good, say Republicans, except then they propose these sort of workarounds that only kind of sort of maintain those protections while pretending to. It's really kind of a mess, and there's nobody who has a kind of great alternative to this debate right now, and nobody's really sort of found a way to talk through it.
What was, Peter, I remember these conversations vaguely from years when, you know, the Obamacare battle was like particularly tight, but what was the level of people who could not get insurance because of pre-existing conditions? that were not then covered by state level risk pools and things like that. I mean, is this one of those cases again where like a very, very small number of people, you know, end up or like really extreme cases and unrepresentative cases end up driving an entire debate and taking everything over the cliff with it?
So it's a small percentage at any given time. The Democratic argument is that the percentage is much larger if you choose a sort of time range, right? So in any given year, the number of people who have this particular problem, the percentage of people is relatively low. And I don't have the figures right in front of me. But the argument for these, from the people who support these rules, is that over a lifetime, it's actually quite likely that you or someone in your family will end up benefiting from them. What sort of matters politically is that when you poll provisions in Obamacare, and this has been the case even before the ACA passed, when you poll those provisions, the pre-existing conditions protections are far and away the most popular part of Obamacare. Now, our friends at the Cato Institute have done polling showing that when you present people with the trade-offs and the costs involved, those provisions become do not stay popular, certainly not at the same level that they are popular. So when you just say, do you support pre-existing conditions protections? But there's no Republican out there who's saying, actually, these things add to the cost of health insurance. And what we need to do is reform the way that these rules exist. Instead, what they're saying is, of course, I support pre-existing conditions rules and I would never change them. And then they support legislation. There's a bill, for example, in Congress right now. It's not going to pass, but that a bunch of Republicans support that is designed to give them cover. And here's what it does. It says that insurance companies have to sell you insurance if you have a pre-existing health issue. However, they don't have to sell you insurance that covers that particular issue. So they have to sell you something, but they are allowed to exclude the high-cost pre-existing condition. So is that really a pre-existing conditions protection? Certainly, we can argue about whether it counts or not and whether Republicans are sort of being straightforward and truthful here. I don't think that they're lying, but they're certainly obfuscating.
Is there any and there's nobody who's just saying, like, you know, what we actually need to do is to deliver healthcare the way we deliver everything else?
Not even close.
Which is through relatively free markets, and then we figure out how to deal with the really tough cases on the margin. I mean, this
not
is
even
like
close.
Saying
the
because
the Republican
people are starving,
reform message,
the government should control everything.
The Republican, in terms of reform proposals, what Republicans are mostly focused on right now is work requirements for Medicaid, which we've talked about here before. It's bureaucratizing the Medicaid system and basically making it much more difficult for people to pick up to get those benefits, not just because of lack of work, but because of they don't fill out the paperwork properly. Those requirements are being challenged in court right now. We'll see if they end up standing or not. But that, to the extent that there is a major Republican health reform proposal, that's it. Now, I will also say that since I haven't said enough here, Democrats have been started this year in addition running on the argument that Republicans were sabotaging Obamacare, that all of these changes they had made were really just going to send the program into a death spiral. And in fact, what we've seen is that under all of these Republican sabotage plans, all the stuff that Republicans have done to undermine Obamacare, what has happened? There's been basically no change to the uninsured rate, and health insurance rates in the individual market, which is where Obamacare covers people, have actually gone down. And so that is the extent of Republican sabotage. And so Obamacare, this is part of the sort of complicating things, is that Obamacare has become popular under Donald Trump as Republicans have, quote unquote, undermined it or sabotaged it, except that they're undermining it and sabotaging it has appeared to not do any damage to the functioning of the law, and in fact, may have made it work a little better. You actually, in addition to having the rates go down, you also have insurers who had been pulling out of these exchanges coming back into the exchanges in some cases. So people have more plans, more options, rates are going down, and it doesn't appear that there's any significant effect on the overall uninsured rate. In fact, a little more than 2 million more people were covered And the most recent year we have numbers for than in the last year of the Obama administration. Now, because of population increases, because of population growth, the percentage has stayed the same, but you actually have more people who are insured.
Let's shift to another midterm issue. Nick, we're hearing a lot of discussion this morning, in particular the last few days, about a new caravan of humans.
An army, Matt. An army
of humans making their way.
An army of babies loaded with diapers who are marching from Central America through Mexico. They're going to be in your living room in, I don't know, 3 to 4 weeks.
I think the president tweeted this morning, evergreen statement, that there's some Middle Easterners certainly in there. You could tell.
Unknown Middle Easterners, yeah. What is your question?
Well, if, should you shut up?
Is that the
question?
Barely keeping it together.
We know that the answer is we can just move on.
I'll fail.
You've been following this. To what extent do you assess the politics of this either affecting the midterms or the broader Trump agenda on immigration, either motivating opposition to him or what? What role is immigration politics playing in the midterms as far as you can reckon, or at least on how is it changing American attitudes about this particular issue?
So, I mean, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. And about midterms, I don't follow it as seriously as you do, Matt. So, like, I don't really know how the immigration issue polls to get people to come out or not. What I can say, though, is that Trump has been, since he's been in office and since he's been really kind of highlighting the Republican position on immigration as like one of xenophobia or one of being anti-immigrant. And you know, he's joined. It's not just him. It's also, you know, we've talked about people like Tom Cotton and Senator Perdue of Georgia, who have come up with, plans to cut legal immigration by 50%. I mean, the Republican Party is officially anti-immigration at this point between Trump and many of its members, such as Steve King, who we discussed. Immigration is now, or immigrants have never, according to Gallup, been more favorably recommended by Americans than they are now. Overall American attitudes of people who find immigrants to be a good thing for the country is at 75%. It's 85% among Democrats, 65% among Republicans, and those are historic highs. So the rhetoric writ large about immigration is not working. You know, the idea that they're rapists and that they're criminals and that they're bringing disease, that's not really how people are thinking about immigrants. How that plays out in the midterms, and especially this idea, and I mean, this is a classic strategy of wedding immigrants to things like drugs, crime, and disease in particular, lawlessness. That's what Trump is saying when he's talking about, you know, this group of perhaps 5,000 people. There's no official count that's in southern Mexico. The last time this happened, which wasn't that long ago, by the time they got to the border, it was a couple of hundred people. Who knows what will happen? It'll dissipate before it gets there. And then they get processed like every other goddamn immigrant who comes in, you know, comes across a border checkpoint. Like, you're asked for identification, you have a passport, and you get a rundown on that kind of stuff. And you might get in on a tourist visa or a student visa, or you might, you know, request asylum. Many of these people are fleeing places, and depending on the country that they're from, et cetera, there are programs involved to allow people to escape particularly crime-ridden areas, which, you know, goes to the larger question that I think Peter was getting at about, you know, the Republican Party at this point is becoming, you know, it's a nationalist populist party. And what's interesting is their focus on the southern border and Central Americans, because that's not even where most immigrants come from anymore. There are Brookings and a couple other people who just put out new things, but Asia, you know, going all the way from India to China and Japan and whatnot, that's where most immigrants are coming from now. We reached peak Mexican about 10 years ago, and Central Americans, actually, there aren't that many. And, you know, when you start talking about, oh, there's 5,000 people walking across Mexico, I mean, You know, Matt, you remember Hands Across America. Like, Mexico is a big country, 5,000 people. I know you probably were riding your spider bike in between people's hands and trying to break it up.
I still have
the shitty punk that you were.
I still have a Hands Across America t-shirt from when I went.
The only good thing that came out of Hands Across America was Ramon's video for Something to Believe In, where they staged a fake Hands Across America where one guy was holding hands with somebody with a hook.
I also have a Coca-Cola red t-shirt that says no nukes, except written in the Coca-Cola font from like exactly that same time.
So these are questions about, you know, immigrants. We have gone so far off of, you know, and I guess in a way, maybe this is, you know, this is the, you know, the ultimate kind of, you know, wealthy person's problem. We are dealing almost completely with politics on a symbolic level now. The tariffs are not symbolic. And of course, immigration policy is not symbolic. I mean, these are people's lives who are coming here. There are people who are being put in jail, you know, families being separated. But we are talking about like tiny little bits in the abstract about stuff. And to be honest, I don't know that it's motivating. I don't think the immigration caravan is motivating people in the way that the Kavanaugh hearings motivated people one way or the other.
Catherine, picking up on the symbolism thing, we started this podcast while trying not to laugh at the president's opening jobs, not mobs line. And what I think about, I mean, he didn't actually use that phrase there, but he's been using it in other contexts over the last few days. Like, it's all about the mobs. That's not about the jobs. And it's which is queer, right? Like, it's odd that you can run and campaign on the economy is pretty good. I think it's going to the bubbles are going to start bursting all around us pretty soon and we're going to be screwed. But it's something that, you know, it's a policy outcome that you can certainly campaign on. And yet you could see the glee in his voice and other Republicans like, mobs, we got it. Mobs. We're going to motivate people by their sense of disdain and fear of the other. It feels like there's been a divorce stronger than usual of issues and policies and even results from politics, or am I just getting old and cranky?
No, there's been this like super fast like polarization and like dog whistleization of the word mob. Like, I swear to God, last week this was not on my radar at all, and now like every single person has a very strong opinion about whether we're allowed to use the word mob. And as far as I can tell, mob is currently being used to describe any group of three or more humans who disagree with me politically.
Wasn't there a CNN segment?
Right. So it actually started in August. It started in August, and there was a CNN segment featuring Brooke Baldwin, in which somebody said the word mob, and she said, "We're not going to use the M word here." And if you go find this clip, the real star of the clip is Mary Catherine Hamm, who is like silently in the, you know, the third box off to the left, and she's just making this like girl face that's really
it's
A
like
plus.
It's like being part of the Stanley Milgram experiments.
And it clearly dates from before that, because already like CNN hosts have become upset and allergic to the use of this word by people on the right to describe groups of people on the left who are disapproving of right-leaning politicians, right? So, it wasn't really on my radar, at least until the last, you know, week or so. And, you know, I think you're quite right that Trump has said, like, this is it. Like, this is, I am going to campaign on this. We're going to hear him say the word mobs, like, 10,000 times between now and 2020. I really think it could have quite a bit of staying power. I'm not so sure about mobs, not jobs. That one strikes me as maybe something that's gonna wash out in the A/B testing. But I think that this idea of sort of, you know, the mob. It's very powerful. And America, is, you know, after Charlottesville, is having this moment, at, not to mention the, you know, confrontations in Oregon as well as in New York 2 weekends ago. There is this fear that there's like angry groups of people might start running our politics or controlling our lives or helping influence political decision making. That fear is not entirely unfounded. On the other hand, it's a very weird, hyper-specific use, which Republicans are going to try and play out.
Well, it comes out of the kind of social media discussions about.
Maxine Waters called for, you know, like, don't let a Republican, you know, politician have dinner out. Like,
right,
make sure they go to the drive-thru.
I think the refining of the meme to the word mob is the power, right? Like, politicians are always calling for various types of direct action, and that's nothing new.
Seriously, I mean, I I'm not saying it's a Democratic phenomenon, which a lot of people on the right are saying, oh, this is all the Democrats conjuring this, as opposed to, you know, Trump is having election rallies, which are kind of like mob scenes, where he was praising in Montana Greg Gianforte for body slamming a reporter during the elections here, a previous election cycle.
On the campaign trail, Trump encouraged his supporters to commit violent acts and said he'd pay their legal bills if they got in trouble.
But again, this is it's gross rhetoric. It's not appealing. But I think the idea that there's this brand new. No, I really don't. Like, I really
when
think
is the last time? When is the last time you heard? You know, you saw footage. And again, I mean, granted, you know, some of it is technology so that we didn't have this and stuff.
All of it is technology. 100% of this is that it's now visible, not that it wasn't happening.
But I seriously don't remember in the 90s even. And I may be forgetting it, you know, but like where you, if you were a like third tier congressman, much less the Senate Majority Leader or the Speaker of the House, and you're out at dinner and some guy comes ranting and raving at you and like takes your doggy bag and throws it out on the street. Like,
humanity discovered like random asshole is asshole to identifiable person in public like this week? No, of course not.
So the argument that I've heard for a long time from a kind of elderly DC insider types is that politics in Washington got bad when they brought cameras into Congress, and that because it basically stopped the deal making and negotiating on friendly terms that might happen and turned everything into a recordable kind of campaign event, regardless of whether it actually was or not. Now, we can debate about whether C-SPAN and cameras in Congress are a good idea. That's not my point. But what I do think is different now is the technology that, like we were saying, is that these things can be recorded and then weaponized. It's like not actually all that fun to go yell at Mitch McConnell and
it's
throw his doggy bag.
Famous for yelling at Mitch McConnell,
in,
though.
Like, if nobody knows that that happens, or if like your coverage is that you make page, you know, A17 of the Lexington Herald Leader, which honestly probably doesn't have 17 pages in their A section these days. But it's a lot of fun to do that if you can videotape it on your iPhone, which you have with you at all times, and it can become a viral meme hit thing in which Mitch McConnell looks like a turtle and you throw his food on the ground. And it's like, and so it,
but
it is the.
So like, you guys remember previous times where there was a guy in New York who was arrested for leveling, I guess, credible threats against two senators. Like, I don't remember that. I don't remember that happening even 10 years ago. Much
I
less
mean,
20
there was,
years ago.
There were assassinations, Nick, back in the day.
Yeah, in the 1890s.
No, in the 1960s, the early 70s, the amount yeah, no, of, the no, amount I, of political I violence in the... I
get that. Not of... I mean,
I think,
well,
I
there was
think...
a congressman like Leo Ryan or somebody who went down to check out the temples, you know, People's Temple. But, I mean, are you guys... I guess I can be talked out of it. But, like, is there any evidence that we can go back, oh, and remember when what's-his-name got caned on the Senate floor? That's politics. And, like, you know, Reason did a great video, which is one of our most successful videos of all time, about attack ads circa 1800. But I think you guys are fucking bullshitting if you don't think, like, even in the past couple of years, the rhetoric of day-to-day politics has gotten much more violent, much more coarse, and much more vulgar. And I'm not a fainting daisy here or whatever, a wilting flower on any of this stuff. But there's something fucked up. And like when Rand Paul got, you know, attacked by a crazy neighbor, like that's one thing. And it's not clear if there was a politic dimension, but it was
the dispute there appears to have been about like lawn trash. But no, yeah. Nick, I think you are. I want to actually say, I think you're partially right.
Yeah.
I think you're partially right. I think it has, I think violent-ish rhetoric in politics has gotten worse in the last several years relative to where it was 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, basically throughout my lifetime. But I think Matt is right, actually, to make the assassinations comparison, which was that if you go back to the 1950s or 60s or 70s, if you wanted to make national news and make a big statement, throwing a pie in a guy's face, yelling at them in the restaurant wasn't going to do it. You had to shoot a politician, and that would make national news. And so some people got driven mad and crazy enough by politics that that's what they would do. But of course, it's an exceptionally high cost, exceptionally frowned upon maneuver. And so now what you can do is you can have a, instead of a violent confrontation, let's call it a viral confrontation. And the idea is to go viral with these things. And so because they are less socially costly, right? Like you get caught doing that. I mean, the point is to get caught and to get seen doing this. You're not going to, maybe you get like thrown out of the restaurant. Maybe you spend a night in jail if the cops really don't like you, if there's a little bit of a, you know, sort of altercation. But like the cost is much lower, and the impact in terms of getting attention for what you think is, for your cause, Mitch McConnell or whoever is bad, is significant. And so I think that the incentives there combined with the technology to allow this stuff to sort of spread quickly have made combined with Donald Trump, who is as our president, basically ran a whole campaign built around this. You combine all of those things together, and I do think it's gotten worse in the last couple of years, worse than it was in the 80s and 90s, for sure.
Again, though, I really, really want to disagree about that. Like, I think we are paying attention to it right now, and I think Republicans are demagoguing it for electoral benefit right now, like right this minute. But, like, I remember people used to, you said a pie in the face, but like people used to go after, Bill Kristol got hit with a pie at a speaking engagement in like 2005 or something. That's exactly the same as this, or more aggressively, and in that same period in the late 90s and early aughts, the environmentalist groups like the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front were totally trafficking in this kind of direct action where they would go to the cafeteria where the people who did research on animals worked and like stop, you know, shut everything down. They would put bomb notes under people's cars. I mean, I think right now, this is happening at the very, very top level of partisan political discussion. And so we are noticing it right now in a slightly different way. But I really don't think this notion of small angry groups or individual partisans confronting politicians in public spaces is even remotely new.
Okay, so I'll go back. I mean, one that I do recall is Dan Rostenkowski getting chased by an angry mob of seniors in the late 1980s because he was threatening to cut Medicare. Oh, nothing has changed.
It's
You're
just
right.
not new.
Actually, yeah.
I think that
it has moved up the chain, and it might be, again, I think there's a difference between Animal Liberation Front, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, and they were actually more violent in their threats and things like that. But I do think that political rhetoric has you know, significantly changed in political action, and it may be at lower cost, but I think it's more common. And I'm curious, is there any kind of data that I might marshal in a coming podcast, Catherine, that would satisfy your idea that it is different? Because if there is no data that is even imaginable that would change your mind, then it's not worth kind of arguing back and forth. And I might be wrong, but we really seem to be, balancing in a, on an edge that I don't think we were even a couple of years ago.
What think tank does the dinner interruption count white paper every year?
Yeah, that's Brookings does the dinner interruption white paper. No, I mean, because this is necessarily going to reflect the mode of confrontation and discourse of the times, I don't think there's a way to build a single data set. But we're not really talking about the number of incidents. We're talking about what it feels like. And to you, it feels like this is more common. And I'm saying, I think we're talking about it a little bit differently, but it's not, in fact, more common.
The way,
and it doesn't matter that the president of the United States is congratulating members of Congress who body slam geeky reporters who ask basically, you know, totally legitimate questions.
I mean, Trump, I hate to say this, but like Trump is right. Like Hillary Clinton literally did an interview where she said, we don't have to be civil anymore. It's fine to not be civil until we retake the House.
Okay, but that's not.
No, I mean, like, yeah, we just released a video about it.
Trump isn't right.
Of course it's not. Of course it's not okay.
That it's cool to body slam journalists.
Right. But what I'm saying is, if the question is like, is the fact that Trump said that evidence that we are in a new, different phase? Like, Hillary Clinton is the most establishment politician still to this day. She is old guard, old school, perma, you know, perma political class, and she's trafficking in the same rhetoric.
And I would commend everyone.
She's not going to be president, and Trump is. And this is the big difference.
And everyone should go and stop what they're doing and read my phenomenal column called the Collectivist Election, I think, or something like that, in late
Matt, all of your columns are
thank you but all which I think will hopefully hold up if I go back and reread it, but made the point that during the 2016 presidential campaign in particular, both candidates, Hillary through her deplorables, Donald Trump through a variety of things, but the one that comes to mind the strongest is his denunciation of a judge based on his Mexican-American heritage only, that they were both engaging in a level of collectivist demonization of their political opponents that was startling, new, and bad, and it boded bad bead. I don't know how to past tense that one.
Bided?
Thank you, bade is the right word. Ill for where we're going forward, and I think we're going in that place forward. And I think maybe what to triangulate between Nick and Catherine, I think what we might be seeing is sort of like the intellectual preparation for something that will get worse later. We've seen some bad things already with the attempted assassination of a series of Republican congressmen. That's not a small thing. It's a huge thing. And it's been, if anything, kind of undercovered in this era, especially when you compare this to the way the media overreacted to the Tea Party protests of 2009 and 10. But I think there is a the old debate about whether we should punch fascists and these kind of things. You could see sort of the on the left an intellectual like paving of the way of, hey, let's go ahead and have and relearn the same lessons that we failed to learn 45, 50 years ago, which was at that time, you know, we lost the argument. We need to like step up our game and start bombing some shit. And that delivered two terms of Richard Nixon. So congratulations to SDS and everybody else. We are running a little bit behind here. I could either jettison our late in podcast recommendations of things, or we could do a lightning round.
Lightning round.
I start. Usually we do books, movies, video games, that kind of stuff. I'm going to start with a birthday party. Kat Timpf, our libertarian lonely friend in the Fox News building, held her 30th birthday party. And it's it was actually a media thing. You can follow a hashtag RIP Kat Timpf all over the place because she's a damn millennial. She turned 30, held it as a funeral, came out of a coffin. It was hilarious. And I also mentioned that because happy birthday, Catherine and Peter, who share the same birthday. Catherine, you're
next. Thank you. I am going to very briefly recommend an article in our magazine, which is the Myers-Briggs is Bunk book review by Katrina Gulliver. I am a deep believer in Myers-Briggs typologies. I am an ENTJ and I will die on that hill. I also recognize that it is horoscopes for smart people and absolutely basically based in nothing. This review captures that very nicely. I recommend it if you are a self-hating Myers-Briggs aficionado, especially as I am.
As an INTJ, I'm really kind of skeptical of the whole Myers-Briggs thing. I've been watching Daredevil season 3. It's pretty good. It's returns to a lot of things that made the first season good. This is a Netflix show. Daredevil was the very first of the Netflix Marvel shows, and I think probably still the best, although the first season of Jessica Jones is really good. But I'm also kind of thinking about quitting Marvel Netflix, in part because I'm a little bit behind and it's just so much television to watch, but in part because Netflix has started to cancel some of those shows. In the last couple of weeks, they announced that they canceled Iron Fist, which was admittedly terrible, and Luke Cage, which I thought was really interesting for the first half of the first season until they got rid of some of the better characters. Anyway, though, I'll probably stick with Daredevil season 3 through the end. If you liked the first couple of seasons of Daredevil, non-shockingly, you're probably going to like this one.
I am reading a book from the late 50s called The Holy Barbarians, which is a kind of biograph or narrative sociological report by a poet named Lawrence Lipton of the Beatniks who lived in Venice, California. And it's it was billed as a kind of expose of how Beatniks lived and how they were different and alternative to kind of a conformist, man in the gray flannel suit American culture. What's interesting about it to me is that this is really, you can see how between Beatniks and hippies and kind of through via Dylan and shifting away from jazz and blues into folk music created the 60s and a kind of counterculture that we come to understand that normalized alternative lifestyles. And in that sense, it's really interesting to look at this scene, which happens a beat before that, really. But it's also incredibly depressing because the version of liberation that the Beats were seeking, particularly at that time, has been completely achieved. You can have whatever kind of job situation you want, whatever kind of living situation you want, whatever kind of sexuality that you want. And it's good to be more free, but it doesn't actually answer any of the big questions of what do you do with that freedom. So in a weird way, The Holy Barbarians kind of is one of those texts that tell us how we got to where we are. And it very much explains Bob Dylan and in a strong measure, the kind of the world that somebody like Bruce Springsteen was coming out of in ways that they're not normally associated with. But it's it just seems, in a post-scarcity economy, it's kind of like, okay, well, we're still at square one, which is what do we do with our lives?
I think that's a perfect way to end
it. Really? And we spend it talking about fucking politics. I mean, this is like, yeah, there's got to be, there's a Los Lobos record song that asks, is this all there is about an immigrant who comes up from Mexico and then asks, is this all there is? And which I guess is also any number of jazz and pop standards ask this, exactly that question.
And next week on the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition, we will answer the question, how will the wolf survive? Thank you, everyone, for listening.